Welcome to The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone, sitting in for Mindy Todd. Just mention the teen years to parents, and you're likely to get a groan in response. For many, it's a dreaded time, a time when your beloved child becomes unbearable to be around, or worse, a time when he or she gets into serious trouble. But why do teens do what they do? And how should the adults in their lives respond? Better yet, how could parents, teachers, and others actively support teens in their journey to adulthood? Those are some of the questions neuroscientist Frances Jensen set out to answer when her own sons were teenagers. Jensen is professor and chair of the Department of Neurology at the Perelman School of Medicine at University of Pennsylvania. The result of her explorations is a book, The Teenage Brain, a neuroscientist's survival guide to raising adolescents and young adults. Frances, welcome to The Point.
Thank you. Great to be here.
All right. You're a neuroscientist, but you didn't always study teens. This is something you kind of got into inspired by what you were experiencing with your own sons. Can you give us a couple of examples of what was going on that got you to realize you didn't know nearly enough about what was going on inside your son's brains?
Yes. So I do study brain development, but at a much earlier stage. And I was also a neurologist, and I thought I knew a lot about the brain and development until, of course, my own kids entered into this teen window, and it goes beyond the teen years. We'll talk about that. I recognized that there was a whole other biology associated with the teen years, and I decided I have to get this right. And given the fact I was in the field of brain development, I thought I would just start looking in the literature, and this was sort of about 10 years ago, and there was very little, you know, out there published, and it was just emerging at that point. So I went into it and discovered that there was this whole new field of adolescent brain development research that was emerging sort of in the mid-2000s, 2004, 5, 6, and beyond, and now it has just exponentially increased. So the kinds of things that made me wonder was watching one of my sons as he went from a straight, conventional boarding school with jackets and ties, elementary school with jackets and ties, into a very liberal, progressive high school that, let's just put it this way, his best friend had blue hair. There was all kinds of experimentation going on in that school in many ways, and watching how he was handling it and then not handling it, and then watching my second son, you know, go and make decisions that I would definitely not have made. And of course, we had a couple of
that's
collisions,
a very generous way of
right?
putting it.
Cars were being totaled, et cetera. Classic teen behavior. And so basically, having discovered all this and then trying to sort of talk through it myself, I realized that I was learning things from the literature that, A, was calming me down as a parent, making me be much more patient and understanding, and also sharing it with my peer parents at the schools, them just going, oh, so that's why they do this. So there's a couple of big points to make about teen brains. And just in a nutshell, if the listeners you know, they take away nothing else, there's two big things that happen in brain development. First of all, the brain is the last organ in your body to mature. It's not done until your mid to late 20s. In typically, girls are a couple of years ahead of boys in that journey, but there's always, you know, that's averages. There's early boys and late girls. And what we're seeing is that there's great strengths, but there's also significant vulnerabilities to this window. So it's not done when you're 12. Piaget, who was a developmental biologist, made us all feel that it was done at 12 because that was what his observations were telling him. It's so not done at 12. There's actually a whole other window where even your IQ can change in your teen years. And what's going on? Well, our building blocks for learning and memory, we have brain cells, neurons, and they make connections called synapses. We have about 100 billion neurons in our brains when we're born, and we make about 100 trillion synapses, and it peaks in childhood, and kind of gradually we prune our extra connections down into adulthood. So adolescents are still in that window where they have a lot more connections. And it turns
out, trying to figure out, like, which ones are the good ones, or which
exactly.
ones you can get rid of.
It's use it or lose it, you know, that's the thing. And if you don't build it, then you will lose it. But you also want to get rid of the clutter. That's why nature is doing that. So actually, they have this ability to learn like children can learn 2 and 3 languages flawlessly, right? Because of this, they've got this ability to make connections, synaptic connections. We call it plasticity, which means plastic brains moldable by environment. They've got this enhanced synaptic plasticity, kind of like children, that they'll never have again. So they actually have better, studies have shown, there's real facts that show that their brains can learn faster, harder, stronger, longer than we can. So that's a real advantage. And we'll get to some downsides to it, because of course there's always a double-edged sword a bit. But the other big part, so one is they can learn faster. They're never going to be able to do it better than they can now. So that's an opportunity for them. The other, though, is how do these different brain regions that are literally on fire in that age window connect to one another? And that process of connecting the brain from the back to the front is a process that takes 20 years plus to happen. And therefore, the last part of their brain that really gets connected up with high-speed connections is their frontal lobe. And their frontal lobe, which happens to be in the front of your head, behind your forehead, is where we have executive function, impulse control, empathy, judgment, decision-making, organizational skills.
And it's the last part of the brain.
It's the last part. And meanwhile...
Explains a lot just right there.
Right. And so they have not enough connectivity. They've got it there, but it's not... high-speed connections yet, and I can explain what the biology is there. But the other part is that their limbic system, which is their emotional area of their brain, sexual function, emotion, risk-reward, novelty-seeking, is behind. It's sort of where your ears are. So that is fairly well connected. And so, if you can imagine, they are running with very well-connected limbic systems for risk-taking, novelty-seeking, emotion, without their frontal lobe being able to feed back and go, that's a bad idea, don't do that. Actually, this is, it's kind of illogical what you're saying right now. So they don't have that to the extent they will as adults. So in a nutshell, the fact that they have these wonderful strengths, but there is this vulnerability. Sometimes we liken a teenage brain to a Ferrari with weak brakes.
Okay, I like that analogy. In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with neuroscientist and author Frances Jensen about the teenage brain. That's the title of her book, as well as a topic. We'd love to hear your questions or your own tips and success stories with your teens. Our phone number is 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. You mentioned how there wasn't a whole lot of research when you got started on this, but certainly what you were finding in a lot of ways debunked a lot of myths and some really ingrained ideas about teens that, I mean, you've already mentioned that there's a big upside to the teen's brain and other biology. But what we've typically seen or are focused on societally is just all the negatives.
That's right.
That these are just, kids being willful and pushing back against authority and doing all of this really deliberately. Almost maliciously has kind of been the idea about teens, and you found that's just not the case.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct. And one of the things that struck me and still strikes me is a lot of the times teenagers are referenced in the literature, in the media, just in society in general. It's always with this negative, like, oh, what are they thinking? They're they're crazy, and actually, that's not the case. This is a window. It's a wondrous window of development that I feel we don't necessarily take advantage of to the extent we might, if science informs us in schools, at home, in society. This is a window where they are capable of learning things faster than they ever will again. As I said, your IQ, one of the facts that got debunked is IQ is not set in stone when you're an 11-year-old. It actually can change. A third of the people have their IQ stay the same, but a third go up, a third go down. This is recent studies have shown this in this window between 10 and 20. So that's one thing. The other is saying, they're just lazy. They sleep in and they don't do anything. They're just trying to avoid chores. No, their biology, and we can get to this, is that their whole circadian rhythm is shifted, that they literally biologically are falling asleep later and waking up later. And they're not lazy.
That's been a huge debate. Right. Here and around the country, right, as we're learning that school systems are looking at it and say, well, maybe we should start school later so that we actually have teens in school during their peak learning window. Mm-hmm. And it tends to face a lot of pushback from people who say, look, what are we doing just coddling these teens who should be able to get themselves out of bed? And that kind of gets to a big theme that you talk about in the book, this idea of coddling teens versus trying to corral teens mm-hmm. versus doing something that's more of a partnership and support
right.
for teens.
Yeah. So the school start is a really interesting thing. So quickly, because there's biology behind this, is you go to what makes us go to sleep is a hormone, a neurotransmitter called melatonin, which is the same stuff you can buy at CVS for jet lag. It gets put out in your brain in adults at about 8:45 at night, and about an hour and a half later, you want to fall asleep. It makes your brain want to go to sleep, in a nutshell. And teenagers don't put it out till closer to 11. So they're not really ready to go to sleep till around midnight. Meanwhile, of course, they're bombarding themselves with stimulating.
Then there's the role of social media.
That's right.
Because that's the other argument that comes out is, well, just tell them to get off their phones and tablets and we wouldn't have a problem. We'd all be able to get up and
right.
go to
so
school.
Both things, right? So not only biologically are they not ready to go to sleep, but then on top of that, because they're teenagers, because they're novelty seeking, they're taking all these stimuli in while they should be really trying to calm themselves down to go to sleep. So they're really not ready to wake up, say at 6 o'clock in the morning. It's like, if you think about an adult, it's like waking an adult up at 3 a.m. So their brains are not really awake when we have to get them out because we have to get them to school. There actually have been more recent studies done on performance of these night owl type kids. Not all kids do this, by the way, but most do. And the ones that are the extreme, when they test them in school during the day compared to the kids that aren't night owl types, they do very poorly on tests at like 9 a.m. and do really well at 11 a.m. and 1 p.m. So it really is beginning to bear out that their brains do function better later. There are opportunities to think about early morning the first period of class being one where you could have mindfulness or even a homework window, because of course, because they're teenagers, they probably haven't finished their homework from the night before. So there's opportunities or exercise.
Or maybe, I would say maybe put phys ed first in the day.
So a lot of schools are starting to do that. You can't necessarily change in many towns. You can't make the school day because people have to go to work. But we can change what we do early in the school. I've actually talked to the College Board people because, of course, SATs start at, pencil sharpened at 7:30 in the morning or something. And so it's actually starting to get some recognition that this may not be the ideal. When you get to college, of course, that's why evening symposia and seminars are super popular. They're, voting with their feet, if you will, and they love the end of day classes because they're still in this window.
I mean, historically, though, teens have... they've married, they've held jobs, run farms, run countries, waged wars. I mean, teens have had a lot of responsibility, and we seem to have moved really far to the other end of the spectrum where we now consider our offspring, dependents until their mid-20s and restrict the responsibilities they have, in part in response to this idea that, well, they don't have all that executive function, so maybe we shouldn't be giving them any of that responsibility. Do you think we've gone too far? I mean, where do they need to be in this balance between responsibility and support, or being kind of controlled or given a controlled environment?
That's a really great point. You think about where society over the last centuries has put teenagers. It's very ambiguous and ambivalent. If you think they can drive, but not at night. They can vote. They can't drink. They can certainly go to war, and you can put them on the front lines without their frontal lobes so that they can, they're the first ones to run into battle, right? This has been known for centuries that this is, think about what, ISIS is preying on the teenagers online and young children because they can use peer pressure and these other kinds of influences, knowing that there may not be the innate decision making to go, that's a bad idea, I shouldn't be doing that. So you think it's a very confused picture. I always add, though, car rental companies and the insurance industry known this. They know.
They have it nailed.
But you make a good point. I think we, in days of yore, there were people were on farms. Life was a little bit less. There were less risks that might be tempting teenagers back, 100 years ago, 80 years ago, 50 years ago. And now with social media, the internet, there are a lot of new tools that teenagers can just naturally want to use that may have much greater consequences than, you know, even 50 years ago before this hyperconnectivity.
Well, I mean, we're seeing both with younger kids and teens, you know, a lot of concern about mental health, that kids are stressed, that they're feeling pressured, that depression and anxiety rates are up. Is it that much harder to be a teen these days? And is it just social media like you're talking about? Or what is it that makes it harder to be a teen?
Well, I don't think there are no studies that have yet addressed this. But I think if we just go back to looking at some facts, teenagers are in a naturally novelty-seeking part of their development. That's a good thing teleologically, because it allows you to do trial and error and, you know, get experience. It's also a bad thing because Darwinism can take effect and some of them may not make it. Of course, in our society, we don't have as dire consequences, but we have to be aware that they are much more likely to take risks. I just explained that the frontal lobe is, you know, not as connected. And by the way, when I mean this connection, just for those of you that are scientists out there or even want to know what I mean by that, is that our brain cells, neurons, make these synapses, these connections, but they send these long tracks from side to side to the brain or back and forth or down your spinal cord. And for just like an electrical wire, this is an electrical signal, it has to be insulated with, we see rubber here, but we don't have rubber in our brains. It's something called myelin. It's a fatty substance that's wrapped around these tracks, these long tracks, these processes from one cell to another. And that process, because we've got miles of these long tracks in our brains, it starts in the back of the brain and moves forward. Little tiny cells wrap each of these axons, these tracks. So that process isn't done. And that's the point. They have frontal lobes for decision making. It's just not high-speed connection. So in the split second, a teenager is going to go, oh yeah, I'm going to jump off that rock into that quarry because my friends are goading me to do it. Maybe there's a rock under there, but I'm going to just jump anyway. Whereas an adult would go, you know, I think there could be a rock under there.
And maybe halfway down, the teen actually thinks, oh, what right. if there's a rock down there?
So this is kind of the real biology behind why that is. So this also explains why a really important fact for people to know, which is another myth that needs to be debunked, is that teenagers are actually more susceptible to addiction and also the effects of many substances than adults. For the reason, number one, is that they are likely to take the risk and try something out for the reasons I've just mentioned. But addiction turns out it's a form of learning. You're creating stronger synapses, like you would create a stronger synapse when you practice a golf swing or a vocabulary list. You're creating a stronger synapses in the ones that are connected around that task, the brain cells that are connected around that task. And so addiction is simply just repeated exposure, not to a fact, but to a substance. And it goes in your risk-reward parts of your brain. And so they're creating stronger addiction circuits. And so we see that we have this perfect storm of a risk-taking brain with the ability to unfortunately make...
Yeah.
Right.
We will talk more about that after a short break. That's Frances Jensen, neuroscientist and author of The Teenage Brain. We hope you'll join our conversation with your questions and your tips and success stories. 866-999-4626 is our phone number. More after a short break. Stay with us. You're listening to The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone, in for Mindy Todd, and I'm talking with Frances Jensen. She's a neuroscientist and author of The Teenage Brain, a neuroscientist's survival guide to raising adolescents and young adults. Frances, you were talking about the fact that the teen brain is more susceptible to addiction, and of course, this is more of a concern than ever right now with the opioid epidemic. There's been this idea around for a long time, though, that teen brains, like, you know, teens experiment, and they bounce back. But you give about half the book almost to, you know, one chapter for alcohol, one for marijuana, one for opioids. This is a huge issue, and teens' brains don't necessarily bounce back.
Right. They are going to, because they have more synapses, more connections and in their brains than they will later, it turns out that most substances of abuse act at synapses. And therefore, they have more sort of real estate for drugs to attach themselves to and exert an influence over. And it's all happening while the brain is still trying to grow. So if you you know, affect a brain on a daily basis. More of this is the chronic use, like chronic cannabis use, meaning daily use, or chronic opioid use. We see that it's not just in the moment they get more attached to it and create, you know, stronger addiction circuits. It actually affects the way their brain will be later in life. And that's where it can permanently affect, you know, your IQ. It can permanently affect other attributes, and certainly your ability to, you know, the fact that you might stay as a with increased risk for addiction lifelong. So one of the most important parts of this is that there's plasticity that can undo that if you get it there in time. So a lot of, you know, of rehab centers are seeing a shift in their population from, say, Wall Street, you know, alcoholic 40-year-old men to, you know, 18 or 16 to 26-year-olds with opioid and other addictions. It's actually a big shift in the population. But the good news is if you have them there in a rehabilitative setting, if they're in a rehabilitative setting, this is the one, you know, one opportunity that you can still capture that last plasticity of the brain before you head out of your mid to late 20s, right? Because there can be success in rehabilitation at that point. But beyond that, it really paints a less you know, rosy picture. So if they get help early, and this is why it's so important for parents and teachers to be aware of what their, you know, adolescents are, you know, could they be, you know, walking down the path of substance abuse, or are they depressed? Do they have other mental health issues? And it's a time, I think, for us to stay with our antennae up. One important thing about brain development is that not only is there this, you know, propensity for addiction, it's that your frontal lobes, as they become attached, you need your frontal lobes in part to actually do mental illness of certain kinds like schizophrenia, bipolar, depression. They have their onset between sort of 16 to 25 or so. It's these diseases come on later in the teen years and early 20s. And that's not a coincidence. It's because of the biology. So we know this. 60 to 80% of people with major mental illnesses, affective disorders like this, schizophrenia, depression, and bipolar, have their onset between 18
sometime
and 26.
In those teen years. Yeah. You're listening to The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone, sitting in for Mindy Todd, talking with Frances Jensen about the teen brain. We'd love to hear your questions or your comments. Our phone number is 866-999-4626. You can also email us, thepoint@capeandislands.org. You know, we heard President Trump this week kind of going back to the just say no idea with the opioid epidemic. Can that work with teens? Is that it doesn't seem like it's necessarily been very effective in the past, but is this idea of kind of abstention and just say no? Or is there some better message that we could give teens with regards to drugs that might resonate more mm-hmm. with where their brains are, the risk-taking, the experimenting, the feeling that I'm immortal, and of course I can try drugs and I won't get addicted. It's not me, you know.
Yeah, I think that we've learned that the abstention message with birth control, you know, has not actually been the most effective way of doing that over the years. So I doubt that this with opioids would really have much of a major success. What we realize is that education may be a really important part of this. So as look, this is the first group of teenagers that have really had this amount of science to explain like this behavior, this brain stage that they're in. And I always say to them, you know, you're the first group of teenagers that have had this information about yourselves. And when I do talks to high schools, the kids often go like, oh, this makes sense. Now I know why I did that stupid thing on Saturday night or whatever.
I love it. It's not just the parents that like right. the information. The teens like to have
because
this
it's
too.
They're trying to find their identity. So it is a time where they're sort of trying to explore the world themselves, taking these risks, novelty seeking. So our environment, though, offers a lot more risks. I mean, opioids were never as available as they are now. In the history of mankind, I doubt, you know, that they were as available as they are now to anyone who can just sort of connect through however they do, but they can get it very quickly. And so it's very much in the environment of these teenagers. So it makes we as adults, we have our frontal lobes and they're connected. And so I say, give them a frontal lobe assist. And when I say that, I mean that we have to sort of do some rehearsal with them through these risky moments, because they're going to be much more likely to succumb to the temptation when they're, it just hits them, you know, out of the blue with the peer pressure. Try this. I want to be popular. I'll try it. And then they go down this biological path you can't reverse of addiction, right? So one of the thoughts is that they are really amazing learners. And so if we think about common kind of threats, if you will, in their environment and try to sort of rehearse with them at home, this is where parents can be useful, as I say, frontal lobe assist, or schools and counselors, is rehearse for them risky situations. Give them some language, some sentences that will help them, gracefully, if you will, get out of a peer pressure moment, so that it's at the ready. Because I can guarantee you it's very unlikely to be, you know, developed within a split second in their brains at the time that they're facing this peer pressure.
So I recently read, probably a lot of people have seen this on the internet, a father who had come up with a plan with his teenage son using all this great technology that we have, actually, in a really positive way. What they rehearsed was, you get into a situation where you feel at all unsure, you text me. And they came up with kind of a code so that even if his friends like looked at his phone, it wouldn't look like "Dad, help," right? And the thing was, you know, you text X to me and I will call you and say, "I'm coming to get you. You need to come home for whatever reason. There's been something that's happened at home." And the parent comes in and pulls them out of that situation. Mm-hmm. So creating, like you said, that was like a rehearsal. But to me, it was like, oh, that's a brilliant strategy to give the teen an out, and kind of blame it on the parent.
I think that's a wonderful example of how to use this kind of information. And I think it also helps develop a very strong bond between the parent and the child, where you're there and available. You know, this is not...
I guess that was also part of it. It was that it was going to be no questions asked. Dad would come and pick you up from wherever you were, and there would be no, why were you at that illegal party? Why were you doing X, Y, and Z?
That's
it's
right.
Just you're out of the dangerous situation
That's
in your
right.
home.
And this is a great approach. It's also can be used for much more, everyday situations, like, for instance, modeling for your kid how to plan packing for college, you know, or how to even go about the college selection process. Here we are at the end of a summer, right? Let them show them, guide them through some organizational steps. This can happen every night with the homework list, right? And I think parents can, they can learn what they don't do innately, split second wise. You can learn it in the meantime until it will come, their frontal lobes, if you will, come online later, several years later. So everyday events can be giving them opportunities to sort of explore organizing their day and saying, well, you know, you really should probably do the hardest thing first or whatever, gives them an idea that, yes, I can organize things. You can do a frontal lobe assist there. This, what we're talking about with a more like dangerous situation, is really the same idea. It's giving them a rehearsing with them a way to get out of a situation. Or what I would often, I remember being a parent when things, terrible things happened in our, you know, social circles and school circles, kids that committed suicide, DUIs. And I made sure I brought it up and I had a conversation with my kids about this. And they're like, "Mom," you know, but I did.
How,
and I went
How early is too early? I mean, if we're talking about rehearsing in maybe a grander sense, right, with preteens or younger kids, when those kind of teen issues come up, how early is too early to start talking about these and rehearsing those situations?
I think you have to be sensitive that you can't, some things are not appropriate to discuss, you know, with a preteen that are going to become very appropriate and very real and immediate for a teenager. I think you want to use these as A plus B equals C to expose the causality that went into an anecdote of an event that happened, and they, you know, really making them aware that A plus B equals C, even when their brain may not be doing that online. We also need to be mindful of, like, stress. So when I said some things are not appropriate early, we do know a lot about stress during development and its long-term effects. First of all, stress can decrease your ability to learn. So this synaptic plasticity, that building stronger synapses, ironically, so much of what we're talking about that teenagers happen to do, you know, chronic cannabis, alcohol, all these things impair this very process of learning and can make it a challenge for them. But stress can also, it also affects this process of plasticity. So they will be less capable of, you know, using their school years if they're under stress. And B, stress during adolescence actually can increase risk of depression in adulthood. So all of these things you have to be aware are the brain is molding itself. It does basic building blocks sort of through your primary school years. But when you get to your teen years, it's adding sort of the more eloquent parts of your brain, the cortex of your, you know, your associative and your frontal cortex, these last places to connect and be built. And they're very sensitive during this window.
We're talking with neuroscientist Frances Jensen about the teenage brain. Our phone number is 866-999-4626. Chuck is on the line from New Bedford. Chuck, what's on your mind?
Hi, I'd like to pursue this frontal lobe connection question a little more. I've been long interested in the subject of teaching risk in schools, teaching about risk and the analysis of risk. Dr. Jensen, do you think that it's possible that using sort of structured curriculum to have students engage in risk analysis or decision-making in risky situations could actually speed the development of the frontal lobe connection pathways? Mindy Todd on her program has done shows about mindfulness and some of the research that is being done on the Cape in connection with both Yale and Tufts.
Chuck, thanks for your call. A provocative question and also bringing up that important topic of mindfulness. But I love this idea. Could we actually take some of the risk out of risk almost?
Well,
structured risk analysis. Like, is there some way to do that?
Yeah, there is no. So, basing this on facts, there are not any studies to show that teaching people risk reward actually enhances this process of myelination, you know, into your frontal lobe. There's no data about that. Maybe the study will be done at some point because we have beautiful, you know, neuroimaging tools that are available to us, now. But so we don't know that. But what we do know is that they can learn. And if you can put it in the context of, you know, this is risk A, this is a way to handle it B, then C won't happen. So I think that there is one important part of this is to explain to them that you might be teaching them risk as an adult, but they don't have the same neurological equipment that you have as the teacher. They are not going to necessarily interpret everything the way, you know, an adult would that you'd be talking to them in this class. So I think if you do if you have courses like that, they have to be built to accommodate where the teenage brain is, and it's not where the adult brain is. But simply also incorporating into a course like that that your brains aren't there yet is actually probably a really useful thing for them to be mindful and aware of. I agree.
Yeah, and maybe that kind of combination of being mindful that your brain isn't there and maybe just even mindful of, oh, I'm doing something that's a risk might... Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting idea. That's Frances Jensen. She's a neurobiologist and author of The Teenage Brain, a Neuroscientist's Survival Guide to Raising Adolescents and Young Adults. We hope you'll join our conversation at 866-999-4626 or by email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a short break. Welcome back to The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone, sitting in for Mindy Todd. I'm talking with Frances Jensen about the teenage brain. She's written a book that's a neuroscientist's survival guide to raising adolescents and young adults. We hope you'll chime in with your questions and parenting success stories. 866-999-4626. You can email us at thepoint@capeandislands.org. Frances, we've talked a lot about neurons and parts of the brain and what the brain is doing actually growing during the teen years. But then you've got this other thing that everybody loves to use as the scapegoat for all teen behavior, which is hormones, raging hormones in teens. And I was shocked to read in the book that, in fact, teens don't have higher levels of these hormones than, say, young adults. They do have higher levels than younger kids. But it's not all the hormones' fault. So what's going on there?
it's not all the hormones' fault. The hormones are definitely there. And don't forget, the brain is seeing these hormones, or feeling, I should say, these hormones for the first time. So the brain has had no experience with the hormones. So it's a new experience. So they have to learn how to manage that.
But I mean, it's almost like a drug. It's like being high on hormones, kind of.
Well, yes. But actually, more of the emotionality that we talk about doesn't necessarily track back to too much testosterone, too much estrogen in the progesterone or estrogen in the brain. What we see is that this is a time window where, as I mentioned to you, you know, the brain is slowly connecting itself from the back to the front, and the emotional areas of the brain, which are sort of halfway to the front, are connected more than the frontal lobe, so that they tend to be more emotionally responsive without the frontal lobe being able to say, don't get so excited about that. In fact, studies have been done, fascinating studies using functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, where you can actually look at the person's brain and see the areas that are metabolically active during a task, for instance. And so they would show this particular study, a couple of studies that are really striking, have exposed teenagers, children, teenagers, and adults to the same stimulus, which would be a emotionally concerning, disturbing, evocative pictures of people's faces that are looking in distress. And when you compare the amount of how much the brain lights up, if you will, with this imaging technique, this metabolic activity, in teenagers versus adults and children, the teenagers are basically lighting up these regions about twice as high.
I mean, that's the classic teens overreact to everything.
So what it is saying, that there's real biology. So when you say teens overreact to everything, actually, there's real biology. So they are much more reactive. I always say they're experiencing emotion in technicolor, whereas we experience it in black and white. And an example would be if, you know, your daughter comes home with, she's crying because somebody wore the same outfit or had the same backpack as she did, and you're looking at her like, this is not an international incident. What is going on? This is, you will make it through this. And she's like, this is the end of my life. And then if you were to do a brain imaging on her at that moment, her brain would be reacting to the extent yours would be with an international incident. So you have to realize that they really are reacting that way, and that it's definitely they're feeling it more because they aren't reasoning their way through. Now, there's an extra twist to this, is that we've also seen, and this is sort of fraternity party behavior, where emotionality sort of spirals its way up, like a feed forward kind of spiraling up. And there is possibly a hormonal explanation to that. Tetrahydropregnenolone, THP, is a hormone our brain puts out when we're under great stress and in a fear moment. And in a way, it for adults, it calms you down. So if you've ever had that terrible thing happen, you've gotten very anxious and you're shaky, and then suddenly you calm down and you take control of the situation. We've all had that. Yeah. That's because we're adults. Because THP comes out and then it bathes your brain, parts of this brain, that part of your brain, in a more sedating way to kind of calm you down. Ironically, in teenagers, that very hormone, because of the way their brain is still not fully mature, actually ramps them up and causes more excitation of their brain cells.
That's fascinating.
So they can really go spiraling up. And, it's important for parents to recognize this, and teachers as well, when they're looking at, you know, how kids are managing, you know, emotion.
I've heard it said that teenagers are kind of like toddlers all over again in a lot of ways. And actually, listening to you talking about the, you know, the degree of reaction, right, with toddlers, there's kind of a recognition that, first of all, they don't recognize the difference between a need and a want, right? It's all just, it is a need. They need that thing that we're looking at them going, you don't need that toy, you want that toy, but they don't recognize that difference. And it's kind of like what you're talking about, that, you know, the person wearing the same dress is an international. And how fair is that comparison between toddlers and teens?
Well, I mean, as you know, you're smiling right now. It's a gross oversimplification, but what it speaks to is that we give the parents of the toddler a pass. We don't think they're horrible parents because their kid is having a meltdown on a plane flight, right? At least most of
us
don't.
We try not to, yes.
But, you know, as teenagers, though, we think it is a reflection on the parenting. We think we give all these other the reflection on the kid that there's maliciousness in. We have to realize that this is a brain state. Yes, they can be taught. We need to be more mindful that some of this is not completely voluntary, but a lot of it can be managed. So in a way, it is a kind of a reasonable sort of analogous. It's a different brain stage, though. It's much, obviously, much more complicated in the teen years.
So let's talk about punishment then. Because, you know, you're saying, well, we give toddlers a pass, but we don't give teens a pass. How much of a pass should teens get? I mean, there are cases where, you know, teens are doing things that have lifelong, real-world, serious repercussions, not only for themselves, but for other people. Attitudes mm-hmm. towards, you know, incarceration of juvenile criminal offenders has changed. But kind of if you go from the science, like what does punishment do, if anything, that's constructive? And what are maybe some more constructive responses?
Well, I think as, again, a lot of this is that we're only really realizing, you know, there's more to learn about the adolescent brain and there's more to come. But we know a lot more than we did. Our social environment is so much more filled, I think, with opportunities for adolescents and young adults to take risks on themselves, on others. So we need to sort of relook at this and reimagine the adolescent's place in our society. And I don't think that conversation has really appropriately incorporated enough science in it. I was part of two amicus briefs to the Supreme Court about mandatory life without parole. One was Graham and Sullivan, and the other one was Miller and Jackson, which are these, you know, people committing murder, you know, before the age of 18, and how there used to be a law of mandatory life without parole for everybody. And what we were able to do is explain to the Supreme Court, which actually went with their ruling was in favor of to make it an individual decision, that there is an opportunity for some of these people to be rehabilitated, and probably the worst place for them to be for the rest of their lives is in a prison with other people who committed crimes as adults who are teaching them now, you know, really not great things. So I think we have to think about this even much more mild situations like school, you know, one strike, you're out type of, punishment that sometimes happens in schools. To what that should that be applied? How much of a favor are you doing that kid, you know, by expelling them at that point? What are you creating? And what we have to do more thinking around this.
Because I actually ended up in a conversation with some teens last week where they were kind of laughing at the whole idea that the punishment for truancy was suspension.
Yeah.
That if you didn't come to school, you got punished by being told you couldn't come to school. And they recognized
the irony.
The irony and the kind of mm-hmm. futility of that mm-hmm. style of punishment.
Yeah. So these are opportunities for rehabilitation, which, as I said, just like in substance abuse and just like even with mental illness, the sooner you get to, treating somebody with a mental illness or with addiction or somebody who has made a bad decision that has resulted in an illegal, you know, an arrest or something, this is the window to do the rehabilitation in.
Let's turn this around, because we've gone down a lot of the, you know, maybe avoid negative or what to do when something negative happens. But you started off saying that, in fact, the teen years represent huge opportunities. In the book, you use this phrase that teens are jacked up on learning. Mm-hmm. This has got to be a period when you could do amazing things as well.
That's right.
And we have seen, you know, to go to teens' role in society, we sometimes see teens doing amazing things where maybe it's that lack of the frontal lobes where they don't realize that maybe this idea is right. Like, well, you know, a scientist who's 30 would think that's a stupid idea, but I think it's a great idea. And suddenly they've come up with a cure for a disease. Mm-hmm. How do we take advantage of what teens have to offer?
So that's what comes back around to what we had said earlier, is that, you know, so much of the literature around adolescence is negative. It dwells on, oh, they do this, they do that. And but the real part of this is that there's opportunities that we don't capture, as I think I said before, educationally and in society, the opportunities that you have with this sort of fertile brain, with this ability to learn like it will never learn, you know, again, essentially. And I think there's especially, say, during the summer, since we're here in the end, the waning part of summer, there are, this is a time, teen years is a time to build upon your strengths and also to work on your weaknesses, those that matter, right? Nobody's perfect. We all have weaknesses, you know, and strengths. But given this opportunity they have with synaptic plasticity and experiential learning, this is a time to catch up on, you know, on weaknesses with reading or math or and also build on strengths. But also, getting back to what you were saying, a time to explore in a safe setting, trial and error. There are many of, you know, when they get back to the school year, they're going to be faced with everything being recorded. Everything's recorded on Facebook, social media. Everything's recorded in their transcript. And there's not a lot of margin for error. Summer is a time where you can let them, give them a range of choices, let them explore. Was that a bad idea to prioritize this over that? You know, really work on a lot of, you know, sustaining experiences that they won't be able to get when they're nose to the grindstone back at school. So modeling for them, organization, planning for the next year, helping them make choices. This is a wonderful opportunity in the summer, and there's still a few weeks left.
Okay, but let's think about after that few weeks as well. Get in some fun and experimentation during the summer, and then how do you help your teen get ready to go back to school, make that transition, and be ready for the challenges of the school year?
Yeah, so I think filling them with this hopeful message that your brains are ripe for learning. You have better synaptic plasticity than the parent does, than the teachers do, and you can just go at it. And you can also reverse weaknesses, you know, to some extent. Now, remember I said, and I hope people got this, that your IQ can change in your teen years. And this is really important because there are a lot of people who are, quote unquote, late bloomers, who around 10th or 11th grade start to turn that corner from the non-student into the student. And we're very lucky in this country. We have a school system that doesn't track people, you know, at age 13 or 14 based on some standardized test into vocation or, you know, academia, right? We have wide open. And then even beyond that, we have community colleges that you know, there's a lot of opportunity in our society for online, you know, ongoing learning in this really powerful window.
Talk about that ongoing part a little bit. We've got just a couple minutes left, but, you know, this is a window. The teen years, if we think about it as a discrete developmental phase, does have an end where you hit young adulthood. Is that the end of all the risk and the end of all the opportunities?
No, actually. So the brain, this process of myelination, wrapping these, you know, to make these high-speed connections, doesn't finish, large part of it doesn't finish until your mid to late 20s. And in fact, more studies have been done using, you know, advanced neuroimaging on the human brain, and much is backed up by also animal research, that this process continues through mid-adulthood. In fact, we continue to create faster connections into our 40s and 50s as, you know, humans. So there's a lot of opportunity for honing your skills, but still, the most fertile periods for, you know, creating connections are happening in childhood, as I mentioned, which we all know that, and through adolescence and into through college years.
For parents who are looking for more information, resources, tips, other than your book, of course, do you have ideas? Are there, you know, websites or types of places where you can go to look for resources specifically for supporting teens?
I think it's good though to interpret those websites with just knowing a little bit more about the biology, and that's where, you know, I hope that I've helped people understand like the real facts of where their teen brains are. And then I would just say that when you're dealing with your teenager, they usually don't listen to you. Like, you say, don't do this. They're like, yeah, right. But if you say, look, there is this known. Here, take a look at this. Sometimes you're backing yourself up with facts. That can actually be very powerful. So as I said, you know, we need to use our frontal lobes to give them a frontal lobe assist.
Frontal lobe assist, find some facts and share them with your teen. That's Frances Jensen. She's professor and chair of the Department of Neurology at the Perelman School of Medicine at University of Pennsylvania and author of The Teenage Brain, a neuroscientist's survival guide to raising adolescents and young adults. Frances, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
I'm Heather Goldstone, in for Mindy Todd. Thank you for your questions and comments, and thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.